So in this text, we have studied Upanishad is the highest knowledge, which is the culmination of all the other knowledges. You start with prayer, you start with service, you see the Lord's presence everywhere, and then you are ready for study of the Upanishads. So in this text, we had studied about the technique of meditation and how one can detach from the world, develop detachment, and then turn the mind's attention to the highest self, the Lord within. So last week we had talked about whether God is form or formless. That's what we had discussed last week, that God in reality is formless. He is all pervading. Everything is nothing but that one consciousness. Because the moment you say God has a form, then you are limiting. It's only the form of Krishna or Jesus or Buddha or Guru Nanak or whatever the form you are limiting. So they say God is formless, all pervading, everything is Him. But He takes certain forms for us so that it is easy for us to relate. That's what we had discussed last week. When I see Krishna or Shiva, or when I see Jesus, or when I see Buddha, depending on my belief that this form represents God, it becomes easy for me to relate, to love, to develop the closeness to God. Otherwise, if you say He's formless, all pervading, has, you know, it becomes very difficult for a human intellect to comprehend this all pervading formless. So it is easy, so that's why all these forms have been given. And what we have to do is pick that form that is closest to us, that we love, but then respect all other forms of God. If somebody wants to believe in Jesus, that's good. Somebody wants to believe in Buddha, but in Krishna and Shiva, it doesn't matter, because all forms represent that one formless, that one has to appreciate that. So today we'll talk about the formless. Who is this formless? Because that is what we actually meditate upon. When you quieten your mind and go inward, there are some techniques of meditating on the form also. But ultimately the form has to take you to the formless. The particular form I meditate upon is a manifestation of that formless, which is the whole universe. Everything is an expression of that. So we'll just chant the verse, and then we'll try to go over some of the words' meanings today. And there are about 13 indicators or pointers on what is this formless. Because formless, again, if I say formless, it's very difficult to visualize. So the guru, the teacher here, has made it a little bit easier for us to contemplate upon the formless. So page number 30 in your book. Achintyam avyaktam anantarupam shivam prashantam amritam brahma yonim tathadi madhyant vihinam ekam vibhum chidanandam arupam adbhutam. So first one is achintyam, unthinkable. So what they say, that God or consciousness, Brahman, that is the total consciousness, does not have a particular form, does not have something you can think about. Like if I tell you camel, even though there is no camel around, you know, he's in the desert somewhere. Maybe you may have never even seen a camel, but you have seen pictures. So immediately the form of camel comes. He's brown, he has a hump and all that. Or if I tell you that, you know, suppose a lady wants to build a house, or a couple want to build a house, So they visualize in their mind, you know, we want to build a house, we want it to have four bedrooms, and we want to have a living room and a den, and then a TV movie room, what they call that, where they have a theater, and then media room, and then there should be a pool in the back and a garden like that. And so they have all these ideas, and then they go to the architect. They have not yet seen the house, they have not yet built the house, but they have a visual image in the mind what they want to be done. And so then they go to the architect, and the architect says, okay, you know, this is the things you want, this is how they should be organized, depending on the size of your lot, depending on what your budget is, then he will build a house according to your specifications. He will plan it out, and he will draw detailed maps, and then you can sit and discuss with him. He'll make a rough draft, and you say, no, this is not it. That's... So even though you have not seen the house, even though you do not know what the house is going to look like, but you can visualize, you can think about it. So we can think about something that we have known, like a camel, or you can think about something that you can plan in the future. So that is called thinkable, something I can think about. And then, of course, the architect then builds the house, and then it becomes, you know, the contractor builds the house, and then it's solid. And then everybody can now visualize the house. You have an open house. And so what was just a concept in your mind became a visible house, which everybody could see. But the Lord, the consciousness, the Brahman, is said to be unthinkable. You cannot think about it. You have never seen it. You don't know what it looks like. You cannot visualize it. You cannot even imagine what this consciousness will be. That's what is meant by unthinkable. So you say, well, then how am I supposed to know it? Because that's what they say, that in the depth of your meditation, you should experience the presence of Om, the Brahman, the Lord, the consciousness. How am I to know about it? It's unthinkable. I have never seen it. Even the guru cannot describe it. Even a guru who has a realized master, who has seen it, who has experienced it, is unable to describe it. That's what even the scriptures say. Even Muhammad says, even Jesus says, even all the scriptures say that this Lord that I have experienced, you know, these masters have experienced that in their silence when Jesus was, you know, meditating, or when Muhammad was in silence, or when, you know, Shankaracharya or all these great saints, when they were in the silence of their meditation, they have experienced it. But it cannot be described. So then what is the use of reading these spiritual texts? What is the use of reading this book? What is the use of reading Bible or Vedas or Upanishads? These are all pointers which tell us how to contemplate upon that which cannot be contemplated upon, how to think about the unthinkable. Why is it unthinkable? Because it is the subject. All I can think about is an object, right? I can think about an object. I can think about this chair. I can think about Tom. I can think about the window. I can think about the moon or the sun. Or I can think about my body, my mind, my intellect, my desires, you know, the ego, the perceiver, feeler, and thinker, or this world of objects, emotions, and thoughts. But that which is enlivening my intellect, because it is my mind and intellect which think, that which is enlivening cannot be thought of. It can only be indicated. The example they give, which is a very famous example, we have talked about it before, is that you're in a pitch dark room. Absolutely, the lights have gone. And you have a flashlight in your hand. And, you know, you say, find the flashlight, because, you know, otherwise I'm running into the walls and running into objects. So you turn on the flashlight, and now you can see the objects in the room. You can see where the table is, where the chair is, so I don't hit my head or don't bump. And so, you know, so with the flashlight, I can see everything in the room. But then somebody says, you know, the flashlight is very bright. It's such a good, you know, what is the battery that you have inside? You know, the cell, is it ever ready, or is it Duracell, or is it, you know, what is the cell, the battery that you have in your flashlight? And it seems to be lasting, you know, long lasting. They say ever ready is long lasting, or Duracell, they show the rabbit running forever. So I want to know what is the battery. So you take out the batteries, and then now you turn on the flashlight. You can't see what is the battery in the room, in the flashlight. The light of the bulb cannot illumine the battery. It can illumine the whole room, but cannot illumine the cell, the battery, which is illumining the flashlight. So similarly, my mind and intellect can visualize everything. My body can see everything. I can see, hear, smell, taste, and touch. So the world is designed to look outside. That's what even the scriptures say, that the Creator created the sense organs to look outside. The eyes see outside, the ears hear, the nose smells, the tongue tastes. And the mind feels the emotions, the intellect, the concepts. But the one that is illumining the consciousness, which is the flash, which is the battery in the flashlight, cannot be illumined by the flashlight. So similarly, the consciousness cannot be thought of by the intellect. It sounds like a difficult concept. Then how am I to know it? How am I to know it, and what is the use of meditating upon it? And we had talked last week, I think, when Barbara asked the technique of meditation, what they say is that in your meditation, you use the intellect not to think about the consciousness. You cannot, because it is indicative. But what you do is that in the intellect, you remove all other thoughts. So when I'm sitting for meditation, I should not be thinking about the future, you know, what I'm going to do after meditation. I should not be thinking about the past, you know, what happened yesterday, what did he say, what did she say. So I should remove the past and the future and come in the present. And even in the present, I may have some disturbances. My mind is upset because, you know, my husband said this, or my mind is upset because, you know, I have this health problem. So my body is hurting, or my mind is upset. So even in the present, you should not allow any of these disturbances to affect your thinking, or affect your mind, neither the past, nor the present, nor the future. So the mind that is still, now having become still, and then we teach them techniques, you know, you observe your breath, or you chant the mantra, or you relax your body. So by doing all these techniques, the mind is slowed down, and that slowed mind, when it becomes quiet, it then thinks about what? You think about the one thought, that I am that consciousness. Everything, when we say everything is God, God was alone, was there, and everything came from Him, then everything is nothing but an expression of God, just as all parts are nothing but an expression of mud. Mud alone was, and from the mud came all the parts. Gold alone was, and then from gold came all the ornaments. So similarly, God alone was, and from God came everything. So I am nothing but an expression of that consciousness. And that consciousness, so I am not the body, I am not the mind, I am not the intellect, I am not the perceiver, feeler, and thinker, but I am the enlivening consciousness. That thought should replace all other thoughts. But ultimately, even that thought has to end. That thought itself should end also. Even that idea that I am that should be removed, and the mind should be made completely still. The example they give is that suppose the fire is not burning very well. You take one stick and you move the other sticks around, and then the fire gets lit up, you know, which was dying. And then ultimately that stick also gets burnt in that fire. So similarly, that thought which removes all other thoughts can get ends. And then in that silence, the shining consciousness reveals itself. So I cannot cause the consciousness to reveal itself. All I can do is make my mind still, and the consciousness is revealing itself even right now. Right now I'm speaking, you are listening because the consciousness is functioning. Through the eyes you are seeing me, through the ears you are listening to me, through the skin you are feeling the fan. So all the consciousness is expressing through the sense organs. So you turn your attention to what is it that is illumining my mind, my intellect and my body, and that consciousness I am, and that will reveal itself. So we don't have to do anything. All your intellect can do is still the mind, and in that still mind the consciousness reveals itself. That's why they say it is unthinkable, it cannot be thought of. Is that clear? Have I made it clear? Then they say unmanifest, avyaktam. The second is it is unmanifest. Unmanifest means it is nothing like what we have seen before. Like if I tell you, suppose you have never seen a kangaroo, and somebody, you have never even seen a picture of a kangaroo. And kangaroos are only in Australia. So then suddenly somebody says, I went to Australia and I saw this animal which had two legs, and then two little legs and had a pouch. And you can't understand that because you have never seen a kangaroo. And then somebody, he shows you a picture. You say, okay. Now I know what a kangaroo looks like. Next time I see a kangaroo, I will know that. So kangaroo we have seen, or camel we have seen, or if I tell you a dog, dog you have seen. But suppose I tell you, have you ever seen kachupilu? What? Kachupilu. What are you talking? It doesn't make sense because it is something I have never seen. I have never heard. It's, I just made this up. There's no such real word. Right. So the point is that it is nothing that makes any sense. It is not manifest. So something that has nothing to, no word in the English language or in Sanskrit can describe it. Brahman we talk about. Brahman is again means big. But again, Brahman doesn't describe that. Even though Christ calls it Father in heaven, that's to make us all understand. But again, there is, in the Bible, nowhere is the form shown. Who is this Father in heaven? What does he look like? People have this idea of a long beard and all. But that is an artist's conception. Yes.
But it does say in the Bible that in the end, that we will see God. So evidently, if the Bible's true, he must have an image if we're going to be able to see him.
No, see him is even in the Vedas, they say that you will know him, you will see him. But there is no other word to describe it. You will experience his presence within and without. Yes, you will see, but again, you may see the form that you believe in. Like if you say Jesus, you will see him as Jesus. But God itself does not have a form. God himself does not have a form. He takes all these forms. So when you say see, if you really want to see him, you may see him as Jesus, or you will experience him as a light within. God will not be standing in front of you in a form. When they say see, it is like, explaining to your math problem, and you say, it's very difficult. So then you go to a teacher and he explains to the math. You say, I see. It's not that you saw the math problem, but the teacher explained it, so the math problem became easy for you to comprehend. So when they say see, it does not mean that you will see him with your eyes. At that time, you will not even have eyes. You will have a subtle body at the end of the creation. But you will experience, which even in the realized masters even experience right now. Realized masters experience God, but not as a form, as the consciousness or light within. So when they say see, it means you experience his or her presence as life, as consciousness. So that, and the end does not mean that the end of the universe, at the end of your ego. When my ego ends, the perceiver, feeler and thinker ends. Because otherwise, if you see him after death, then you say, what is the use? I don't even know whether I'll know him or at the... When they say that at the end of the creation, what it means is the end of the ego. Because each one of us creates our own world according to our ego. Like a doctor will have his world, a dentist will have his world, and a world of dentists, where they go to seminars and meet other dentists. A hunter will meet other hunters. A bridge player has, you know, meets other bridge players. So each one of us creates our own world based on our ego. But when that ego ends, when I and God are not separate, then in that end of that world of mine, I will experience God's presence. So that is what they say. He is unmanifest. But when the ego ends and your mind becomes still, God manifests. So avyakta means unmanifest. It is like in the book, the example they give is like the ocean. The deep depth of the ocean is not manifest to us. I cannot see if the ocean is 30 or 40 or 50 feet deep. But when I see the waves, I know that there is a deep ocean which is appearing as the waves. The ocean, the depth I cannot see, but the waves I am able to see. So similarly, the consciousness which is unmanifest, I am not able to visualize, but I see its manifestations. I see all the men and women and the trees and birds and plants and rocks and mountains and the sun and the moon and the ocean. These are all the manifestations of the unmanifest. So that which is unmanifest appears as this ocean.
Is that same as the Holy Spirit?
So the Holy Spirit is that one? Yeah, is that enlivening consciousness, which is the same as Om. That's how I understand, unless there is some other meaning for that. But it is enlivening consciousness. Energy is subtler than the body. See, the body, mind, and intellect are something which is, you know, more visible. But the energy is subtle. And energy is what, you know, drives this. It's like the engine. It's like the gasoline in the car. So the energy. But the one that even is subtler than the energy is that. And that's why it is so difficult to conceptualize. For most people, even the idea of energy sounds like something crazy. You know, that, you know, people work with energy and all, and they all, you know, but there is, you know, there are practitioners who work on energy and all. But that is the one that actually is the source of the energy, the origin of the energy, the one that is the source of all the forms. Anantarupam, that will be the next one, the one that is the source of all the forms, whether it's gross bodies, or subtle body, or the causal body, or the energy, or whatever. Because again, if you look at physics, if you see physics, they used to first say only there was molecules, and then they discovered the atom. You know, some of the physicists, they bombarded it with energy, and they destroyed the atom, and then it broke into electrons, neutrons, protons. And then even subtler than that, they find the subatomic particles, neutrinos and all these subatomic, and then sub-subatomic. Actually, there was a few years back, we had a seminar at Memorial where this professor came from, one of the very prominent physicists. We were able to get him to come, and he actually talked about all the subatomic. And then he said that even as physicists, we ultimately come to a place where we don't know what is beyond that. And he said that. And that is consciousness. That is God. This is a very prominent physicist. He actually has worked on the collider, you know, which actually is in New Mexico, the collider, and which actually bombarded that and found the God particle, so-called, from which everything originated. But even that God particle is not God. It is the most basic particle from which all other particles emerge. But subtler than even that God particle is God. And so that, you know, God is not an object, but it is the subject. But love is a very powerful emotion that brings you close. So if you love your children, visualize him as baby Jesus. Baby Jesus, who was in the little cradle when the baby appeared, and you know, to Mother Mary. And how everybody came, so you can love him as that. A lot of people, mothers, love God as a child, you know, as Ganpati or Krishna as a baby. And actually, in Hindus, they actually have a little image of that baby, and they actually change his clothes and then give him a bath and then, you know, feed him. And they do all that just as they would do their baby. So they say, if possible, develop a relationship with God. Or if you cannot love him as a baby, love him as the loving father. One who loves me, one who gave me birth, gave me everything I have. Or you can love him as a friend. Or you can love him as a beloved. You know, I love God. He is my husband. You know, so like the nuns. Nuns love, they say, I'm married to Christ.
I can't go there.
But can you visualize him as a loving father? So or as a master or nothing. So then it's fine. Then love him as the formless. Or you don't even have to love him. You can just see him everywhere. Another option is like Mahatma Gandhi. See God everywhere in all the beings. And God is even beyond. God actually never created the world. Actually, the world is not created. It's a dream at the highest level. When you wake up to that reality, then you see that this whole thing is a dream, just as in a deep sleep when you wake up. And you're dreaming, and then you wake up from the dream and you say, oh, the dream was, you know, I was in, you know, Africa, and I was in the forest, and all that is false. So when you wake up, then even this world will appear false. But for creation, they have shown us male and female and all that, you know, that is. But God is even beyond that. Actually, God has no sex. Like electricity, does it have a sex? Is it male or female? No. Electricity illumines all the bulbs and fans and everything, but electricity has no sex. So God is the energy, like gasoline in the car. Is it male or female? Neither, but gasoline is the one that illumines the car and makes it go. So similarly, God is the energy that runs this whole universe. Even energy is just a term. So it's neither male nor female. It's just traditionally called he, but it's not. I many times will say she, you know, he or she, you know, or it. That's why in Sanskrit, the word Brahman is it. It is neuter. Brahman is a neutral term, which means it's neither male nor female. It is it. If you say it is actually the best word way to describe God. It is, you know, everything. So that. Yeah, that or it. Yeah, I am that. Yeah. But you're right. It's... And if you cannot, it's okay. You don't have to love him. But
you can be grateful.
Yeah, you can have gratitude. You can see him as this whole universe. Love everybody as a manifestation of God. That is another way. In fact, there is a very beautiful song that who is this artist? In Hindi, and they say, you know, look at the mountain and then look at the sky and look at the clouds. Who is the one pushing the clouds? And the sun and the moon and each flower, who is decorating each flower? Who the peacock, you know, that's a beautiful thing. Who is decorating each, you know, feather in his tail? There's a wonderful artist. So there are many ways to think about it. But love, only thing is love is a very powerful emotion, like you love your children. So if you have the ability, but if not, that means you are probably beyond that and you are being one with the formless, which is okay too. Not everybody has to have loved the form. If you can connect with the formless as, but it has to be somebody, me. God is again not outside me. God is everything and is me. And so that unthinkable is me, that unmanifest is me, that is me, that you have to, and ultimately you have to come to that. I am that reality. Aham Brahmasmi, you know, soham, I am that. And that, until you are, right now you are convinced that you are Barbara, right? Or you said you are not. For you, Barbara is a thought, which is good. If you are able to do that, you know, that's very good. If you are able to think that this Barbara is just a fictitious entity, but I am the spirit, that's wonderful. If you can do that, that's good. You are already quite much evolved than the rest of us. No, really. That's very good. No, that's good. Nothing wrong with that. So, but then you are becoming identified as that. I am that. And that's good. But for those who cannot visualize that, they have given these pointers. And they have, then we will be talking about the form also. Maybe in about 2-3 weeks when we are finished with this.
to me, it's really easy to love a God that created love. I've experienced love in my life.
Right.
And so it's easy to for me to love a formless being that created that love.
Mm-hmm.
So it's easy for me to love God because I've experienced love and He is the creator of it.
Right. Good. Yeah, that's
so
true.
That helped me.
Right.
So I think in Bhagavad Gita it says that whoever has whatever faith in whatever way they want to worship or identify with me, means the Brahman, I strengthen that God makes it stronger, that belief.
Right.
And God helps them
yes.
to go to that path because ultimately all the different paths come to me.
True.
That is. So, like, you know, if some people, like my grandma, she would have to have a form, and she loved God as a baby, and so, like you were saying, she would do the puja every morning, and, you know, just, and I think what she did was her whole attention was cut from the outside and just concentrating on that form, and that helped her being spiritual. So,
right.
I think everybody has a different way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, so, and every time I was asking her, but where is God or what is that? She said, don't think too much. And that was her answer. Because I was like 7, 8 years old. And
right.
But I don't see him. Like, you know, why isn't he moving or whatever? And he said, you have to feel it. That's all
right.
He said.
Yeah. Yeah. Like the one who made the Arya Samaj, there is a movement in India where they don't have any idols. And he saw God in a particular form, and there were some sweets that somebody had offered, and some mice came, and they were rats came, and they were eating the sweets. He said, what kind of God is this? The sweets, he cannot even drive away the mice. The mice are climbing all over him and eating the sweets. So he said, I don't believe in any form. So he started worshiping fire as a manifestation of God, and he said, fire is God. And so we offered. So then I had an argument with somebody. He said, oh, I don't believe in all these forms. I said, but don't you believe that fire is God? He said, yeah. I said, well, that is a form too. You know, may not believe in Krishna or Buddha or, you know, Shiva, but you say fire is God. Fire is the one that takes. So it's like Buddha was very much against idol worship. And he never believed in idols. And now look at him. You know, they have made thousands of his idols, which are bigger than any other idol. 10 feet, 20 feet, 30, 50, 100 feet Buddhas they have made.
Gold.
Huh?
Gold
Buddhas. And he was very much against idol worship. So because for a human being, it is very hard to visualize the formless. So we like to have a form to connect with. Even Mahavir, you know, he was very much against forms. And now in Jains, everybody's house, they have a picture of statues of Mahavir. Mahavir never was very much against idol worship. We even have a statue of Mahavir in our temple. And then you go to Jain home. I'm not saying anything wrong with it. What I'm saying is it is very deep. So they said Mahavir is God because he's our guru, he's our prophet. And so for them, it is easy to relate to God as Mahavir than again the formless, because that's what he taught about. Mahavir talked about formless. Did you have something else?
So if you develop the love of everything, I guess that's loving.
That's what I was saying. You know, you can love him in everything, because everything is him. But the way I try to visualize, again, it, you know, of course, when I meditate, I try to make my mind quiet and come in the now, and then in that silence experience the inner joy and all. But when I'm doing an activity, especially I always say when I'm walking on the treadmill, I say, who is it that is making this body move? So pay attention not to this body, but who is it that is making me move? Or when I'm, you know, in the gym, or when you're doing activities that are monotonous, you can turn your attention or develop a relationship. You know, like I used to think, I still do think of God as a friend, not as a supreme master. So I don't have any fear of God, because a friend you are not afraid of, a friend you are close to. So if you have that kind of, and even as a child I used to say that God is my friend and he will always take care of me. I don't know where I learned that from. So if you can develop some kind, huh?
He told you that.
He told me
yeah.
that, yes, yes.
Exactly.
I know, because no one told me that.
Yeah, he did.
And so I am not afraid of God. In fact, I make a joke. I joke about him or talk about with him as a friend, you know, because with a friend you can joke. You don't have to be afraid. So so see him as the energy or see him among all beings. You know, it is difficult sometimes to see him in humans, but you can definitely see him in nature. Actually, if you wake up early in the morning, so beautiful. You see the moon, and then you see Venus, and then you see Jupiter and Mars. Oh, gosh, it's so pretty this morning. To wake up around 5:30, I've been getting up every morning to see that. So the moon is on top, and then Venus, Mars is faint, and then Jupiter. Oh, it's so pretty. And the moon is a crescent. Moon is one of the most beautiful sights you would have seen. So you can see God in that. See, you can see that. His, and then you see the light falling, and you think, I'm being blessed. And so pretty, you know. It's. I always try to wake up in the morning and see, or when you see the sunrise, then you can do the Gayatri Mantra, you know, the consciousness that illumines the whole universe. So you can find occasions to remember God. But get up in the morning and see the crescent moon and Venus. It's so pretty. But I always, nowadays, when I visualize in my mind, when I think about him beyond all the space, I think about that spacecraft that traveled, 4 billion miles and passed Plato. And you can actually see the pictures. You Google it. You can see the pictures of Pluto and then the Pluto's moon. And this spaceship is still traveling and traveling. And we don't know how much further it will go, and there is nothing there, all emptiness, and in that the spaceship is traveling, and it's you know, it's wonderful. So astronomy is actually a very beautiful way to see the vastness of God. That's why I enjoy reading about astronomy. That's why I like to look at all these heavenly bodies, and I have my app in my phone that it can tell you which stars are there and which, so I use that a lot. Any articles related to astronomy, I love listening to or reading them or watching them, you know, because it gives you an idea of the vastness. Because it took that spacecraft 8 years or I don't know, so many years, you know, traveling at 25,000 miles per hour, so many years, and ultimately 4 billion miles. And it's only one galaxy, the sun. It's only one sun, and there are billions of such suns, not galaxy, only one star. And there are billions of stars in this Milky Way, and then there are billions of Milky Ways, you know. So how vast that is. And he's beyond all that. Yeah, it's fascinating, you know. It's fascinating. Or any of these, you know, you go into the depths of physics or astronomy or even plants, you know, you go into the details of how many different plants and how many different birds and anything you go in. That's what, the last one is Adbhutam. The last qualities, which we haven't covered, is it's wonder. It is wondrous. We haven't, you know, there wasn't enough space to write all 13. But it is, and I knew we wouldn't be able to do 13, but I thought at least I would do 6 or 7. We only did 2. But it is wondrous. It is wonderful. You just look at a peacock, go to Hart Park. My gosh, how beautiful that is. Who is the artist who sat down and painted it? You know, it's so beautiful. And it's just a simple bird. And how many feathers and... It's gorgeous. Each flower, anything you see.
But well, the sky is different every morning.
Exactly.
Forever. Infinity. It'd be different every to infinity. It's
right.
The same.
Right. The sunrise.
A different picture every morning.
Right. Sunrise, sunset. Yeah, exactly.
Every day.
Mm-hmm. Sunrise, sunset. Every day is different.
It is forever.
Right. And this is only one Earth.
Right.
And I was thinking about, like, Jupiter has 8 or 9 moons. I get fascinated with one moon. There would be 8 or 9 moons, one after the other coming. But I'm a Shiva devotee, and Shiva has the moon on his head. So I that's why I relate to the moon. There would be 8, that would be wondrous, 8 or 9 moons. So you could see one moon after another. Or Saturn has so many rings around it. You know, I mean, and this is only one, you know, one solar system, or one sun. And can you imagine how many, you know, billions of suns there are? It's really mind-boggling. It's wondrous. It's endless. That's what they say, Ananta Rupam. He is endless forms. We don't even know how many. So just, that's why it's so fascinating. Spirituality is such a fascinating. Once you get caught, Swami Chinmayananda used to say, he says, I consider spirituality as one-way street. Is entry only. Once you get in, you can't get out. You get so fast, you get sucked in, you get so fascinated. That's why it surprises me that people come and then they leave, you know, because once you get into it, so powerful, it's so beautiful, it's so wonderful. it's there is no end.
I don't think people really leave. I don't think people really leave. They stop attending.
You know, like people who used to come to our lectures and classes, they don't come at all. And, you know, they say, I have no interest in that. And they stop taking interest. That's what I mean. You know, there are people like that who used to come regularly to classes. The children used to come. They used to go to camps. Now they have no interest. They don't do anything related to spirituality at all. Maybe they practice in their home, or maybe they love everybody, or maybe they see it in a different way. But to me, it's a constant pull. And once you feel that, you know, you are hooked, you know, you can't get out then. I think that, again, His grace is required, I think.
I think it's because the whole concept is so beyond intellect.
Right.
And we constantly try to understand with our intellect that there is a limit. And when some people...
And then it requires commitment. And then maybe they're not ready to commit. Another thing that people sometimes see is that, oh, this guy goes to the temple or church, he hasn't changed. And that's a very common thing. You know, he has been going for 5-10 years. I don't see any change in him, so why should I? That's another thing. You know, I'm not to point fingers, but your husband used to come regularly. Now he doesn't come anymore, and you are still coming. So, you know, he came for quite a while. So that's what surprises me, that once you have been exposed to this knowledge, and if you still are not getting fascinated by that, it's just, you know, it's just unfortunate.
And also, it's just the vibration, whether you understand it or not, just the vibe of being here elevates you, whether you understand it all or not.
Yeah. I think part of the thing is it requires surrender. See, that's what it is. You need to surrender your ego, then you will progress in spirituality. As long as you think I and my, then he will not be there. You know, this Saint Kabir says that the path of love is very narrow. Either I am there or he is there. Again, you can say he or she, doesn't matter. But either I am there or God is there. If I am there, God is not. If God is there, then I am not. Both of us cannot be at the same place.
And that I is the ego.
Ego, yeah. That I is the ego, not I the consciousness. I the ego, as long as this ego is there, that like if I think, you know, I am now speaking, I know so much, then immediately God will disappear from my mind. But if I think that God is speaking through me or I am an agent, then God is. So it is the attitude with which you are doing. If I think that I am speaking, then immediately it becomes a manifestation of my ego, an expression of my ego. But if I truly think that God is speaking through me, then it becomes a prayer, it becomes a service. So the ego has to disappear. And a lot of people have difficulty giving up the ego. And that's why unless you give up the ego, the spirituality, you won't progress.
And so he also has an ego.
No, he doesn't need it.
And it's just like, I don't
know. No, God doesn't need our worship or our praise. He's fine. The worship and praise is for us. It makes us humble. And that is the idea of it is to make you humble. That is the reason for prayer. He doesn't need prayer. He's fine. If you don't pray to him or pray to him, you think he'll be happy or unhappy, he's fine. But if you pray to him, it makes you humble and you come closer. It's the example of the fireplace I've given so many times. The fireplace is there, and if you are far away, you won't feel. You'll feel cold. But as you get closer to the fireplace, you feel its warmth. So similarly, as the closer you get to God, you feel his warmth, feel his love. And that's all. So it is for us. Prayer is not for him. He doesn't need prayer.
Do you feel that the intellect is the spirit?
No, the intellect is matter. Intellect is matter. Intellect is illumined by the spirit. The spirit is giving energy to the intellect is actually just dead matter. The mind, body, mind, and intellect are inert. They have no life of their own. Like,
where does the spirit of man come into this picture here?
The Om is the spirit or the consciousness or God.
That's God's spirit. How
God's spirit.
God's
spirit.
They're not the same?
No, the spirit is, there is, again, spirit is used in many ways. We use it as Atman. Atman is the individual consciousness. And then there is Paramatman or Brahman is the total consciousness. But we believe the individual consciousness and total consciousness are one, appearing as separate, that the consciousness in me and the consciousness in you and the consciousness in Diana, we think there are three separate. But in reality, they are all one, expressing in different bodies. It's like there is a part in this room. There is a part space, and then there is a room space, and then there is a total space. Now, the part space appears very small. It's a little box or a part, and then the room is a little bigger, and then space. But in reality, there is only one space. Space is only one. We have artificially created as the kitchen and the dining room and the hall, but they are all artificial divisions. Actually, there is only one space, appears divided because of the walls. But if you break this wall, then it becomes one with space. Or the part breaks, the part space, if the part falls and breaks, part space becomes one with room space. And then when you break the room space is the same as the total space, but appears divided because of our understanding. So similarly, the consciousness is one, but we think it is your spirit and her spirit and his spirit. It is our lack of our understanding. There is only one spirit, which we call as Om, as Atman, which is the same as
so
Brahman.
God created us, so we're children of God.
Yes.
So how can we be God? We're two different things. God and his children are two different things.
Right. As the ego, as the body, mind, and intellect, yes, I am a child of God. Mm-hmm. When I think myself to be this body, mind, and intellect, I am a child of God. But in meditation, you say, I am that spirit. And once you say, I am that spirit, then God and I are one at the level of the spirit. As long as I think I am the body, mind, and I am a child of God, and I am a creation of God. But that's so far you are identifying yourself with the ego, the perceiver, feeler, and thinker. But when she says soham, I am that, in her meditation, what she means is my essential nature is that. It is like the pot and the mud. Are they separate or they are the same? The mud created the pot, right?
Yeah.
The mud created the pot. But is the mud separate from the pot? Appears separate, right? It is blue and it has a shape and it is painted gold and all that. So, and you don't see the brown mud in that. You see the colorful part with all the gold trim and the leaves and all. But actually, it's nothing but mud appearing as a part. So similarly, we are all children of God, but the essential spiritual nature of ours is that. Without that, I would not be able to function. And if everything, like all parts emerge from mud, so what are the parts? Mud with a different shape and form and name, right? All ornaments emerge from gold, whether it's necklace or earring or bangle. So they are gold with different name and form and usage. So similarly, all of us emerge from God, then how can we be separate from Him? We are God with different name and form. That's why someone is called Tom or Diana or Bill. The name and form is different, male, female, young, old, but we are all essentially that same divinity. And so meditation is going back to my source. That's why meditation
so
is nothing.
We have free will.
Yes. That's why, see, he has created us with a mind and intellect to think.
So he said that we're part of God because you can't separate the gold from the ornaments. That's part of it.
Right.
But the ornaments don't have a free will. We can say we're separate from God and we will be.
Yeah, so then if you say I'm separate from God, then you suffer.
Right.
But what we'll talk about in the later ones, where it says it's joy. Joy can only happen when you become one with Him. As long as you are separate from Him, you will suffer. That's why Jesus, even when He was being crucified, He was not suffering. Why? Because He said, the Father in heaven and I are one. When you become one with that, then you go beyond suffering. And we'll be doing that in the next few weeks about how to go beyond suffering and how to become one with that. So the way to relieve your suffering is to realize I am immortal. I never die. This body will perish. My mind and intellect, is changing. Body is perishing. but I am that immortal. And then you go beyond death. So, okay, you can kill my body, but you can't kill me. That's why all the saints said that. You can kill my body, but you cannot destroy me. Yes.
Is this where that whole concept of the sheaths surrounding the soul come in?
The five sheaths? Yeah, panchakoshas. The five are the first of all is the food sheath.
Yeah.
The food sheath, what I get with food, the gross body. Then is the pranas, the physiological organs, like the breathing, the respiration, the cardiovascular system, you know, what is the physiological. And the third is the mind. Fourth is the intellect. And the fifth is the vasanas, the causal body. And subtler than that is the consciousness. So these five appear to cover the divinity within us.
So, Neil, when the body dies through death, does the mind die too?
No. The mind and intellect and the vasanas, they go to the higher realms and then they wait for another suitable body if you believe in rebirth. The mind and intellect does not die. The thoughts don't die. In fact, in the Sunday class this week, we had gone into a lot of detail.
So is that the spirit, the mind and the
intellect? No, that's the jiva. That's the individuality. See, the body, we all have the same human body made of five elements, air, space, fire, water. But my emotions are different from your emotions. My thoughts are different from your thoughts. My desires are different from your desires. So this packet of mind, intellect, and vasanas, or some people believe only mind and intellect, is the subtle body which travels into higher world. That's why they say when you go to heaven or hell, right, after you die. So who goes to heaven or hell? Not the body. The body is cremated or buried. It's the subtle body which, based on my actions, I may suffer. If you believe in heaven or hell, that I enjoy heaven or I suffer hell. And then there is a world called Bardo, B-A-R-D-O. The Buddhists describe a zone or a world where the subtle body waits for a suitable body to become available. Based on my karmas and based on my desires, I get a suitable body and then I enter a mother's womb to continue my journey. So the mind and intellect doesn't die.
Is it the goal of human life when you get the human form is to kill all the vasanas and melt your mind and your intellect so that you don't have to be in that bardo, but you can go beyond that back to the consciousness?
While living in this body, you identify with that consciousness, you become one with that in meditation, and then in your actions, then you see God everywhere. If that God created me, he created everybody. So everybody is God. So that is how a saint acts. That's the difference between saint and us. You know, he has no likes and dislikes. Or she, again, saint can be women saints. But they have no likes or dislikes. They have no, because they see God everywhere. Once you have experienced God within, then it is easy to experience him outside. Some people start by seeing God everywhere. You know, God is in everybody, all animals, all birds, and he also is in me. So that is one way. Or in your meditation, you experience the oneness with God, then it is easy to see him. See it, her. I have to be cautious now. But to see God, which is traditionally they use it as he, but it is that consciousness. So that's why meditation helps, because meditation is the fastest way to dissolve the vastness. You know, to destroy the vastness, to reduce them to a minimum, meditation is the fastest. In Sunday class, we talked in a lot of detail. I think those who were here, we went into a lot of detail about it. But what happens is you have to go beyond thoughts. Thoughts are the obstacle. So in meditation, first you quieten your mind. But then what happens is those who have gone deep into meditation experience tremendous fear or anxiety or, you know, a lot of negative thoughts. And they say, Mike, is that true? I thought I was a good person. How do I have all these negative thoughts? So they go to their guru. The guru says, you are at the zone of vasanas. And you realize that these vasanas are built over thousands of lifetimes. And so these vasanas, when you experience, then you see all this negativity within me. But then having experienced, because your goal is the consciousness, then you go beyond the vasanas. You ignore that. okay, these negative and positive tendencies are not me. Because by then you are ready to experience that. Then only you will reach that zone when you have, like a diver, you know, first initially he will be only at the surface. But once he is, has prepared himself, then he can go deeper and deeper. And finally he goes to the bottom of the ocean and finds the pearl. So similarly, as you become stronger in meditation, you go deeper and deeper beyond the mind and intellect to the zone of the vastness. Because now your mind is ready for it. Then only you get exposed to that. And then there you experience all the negative. Eknath Ishwaran talks about it in his teachings, that he experienced a tremendous negative energy, a lot of anger and jealousy and all bad emotions. And he said, I thought I was a good person. Are all these bad emotions in me? So then his teacher told him, no, you are in the zone of vasanas. Don't worry about it. And then he went deeper and and then he realized the truth.
When how does it end?
When you decide, you have to decide.
When I realize my consciousness.
When I realize, when you decide that I no longer want to be under the control of my vasanas and my thoughts, then so we all have to decide that. So it only happens when you decide.
So we have the power to stop the rebirth cycle of
rebirth. Yes, yes. But it has to be a sustained effort. It means you have to start living beyond likes and dislikes. Because if I allow my likes and dislikes, I'm strengthening the vasanas. Like I like pizza, for example. Just to give an example.
Tony's.
Yeah. And so every day I go to eat pizza or twice a week or three times a week. I'm strengthening that vasana. Or if I don't like somebody and then I say, I hate this person and I hate this. So I'm strengthening my hatred. You know, I don't like this particular race or this community or I don't like this particular food, or, you know, whatever, or I don't like the Bakersfield because of the weather. So when you strengthen your likes and dislikes, you are strengthening your vastness. So they say remain equanimous. If I have pizza, fine. If I don't have, I'm still fine. So when you have that kind of an attitude, you know, through life. So
if that's the case, then your mind, intellect, and your vastness are a dream.
Yes. So they will disappear. Yeah, when you reach that state, when you wake up to that state. Yes. It is actually a dream, but we are caught in the dream. And in the dream, somebody tells you it, like I'm telling you, it's a dream, you won't believe it. And somebody tells me it's a dream, I won't believe it because I see these walls as real. But the masters tell us that this world is a dream and you wake up to that consciousness. Then everything will disappear, you're right.
You have to wake from the body because there is no way that you can go back to consciousness.
Except if you are that evolved. See, there are some people who realize, called Jivan Mukta, who realize in this life itself. There are others like us who don't realize and keep taking multiple births. But if there is an individual who is so evolved that he has pretty much finished his vasanas, his mind and intellect is very quiet, but there's a little gap between the final step. He has not yet realized, but he's very close. Then they describe a loka called Brahma Loka, you know, where Brahmaji lives. And there you don't have to take birth again. You live in that and there are other evolved masters who teach you. So there also you have gurus who are advanced gurus who will teach you and you will evolve. That is called Krama Mukti. That is sequential realization, liberation. But that's very few people. So best is to realize right now itself that I am not this body and start living like that. That means body will have its ups and downs, but I am not the body. Eventually, yeah, if the body is having pain, I take medicine. If it needs surgery, I take a surgery, but I am not this. It's not affecting me. So if you are able to remain balanced in joy and sorrow, heat and cold, that is the way of going beyond body or beyond mind. You know, mind is joy and sorrow. Body is heat and cold. Intellect is success and failure, honor and dishonor. If I remain the same, then I have gone beyond body, mind, and intellect. To remain the same in health and ill health, joy and sorrow, success and failure. And say these are all phases. The body is going to go through that. It's going to be healthy, unhealthy. Mind is going to be happy, unhappy. Intellect will be successful and fail one day, but it's okay. It's the intellect, it's not me. Right.
He asked for forgiveness for them. So.
Yeah.
That's what it is, that right. You become one, then you live beyond the body.
Exactly. He's beyond body consciousness. And sometimes the reason even the saints suffer, there are two or three reasons. One is, you know, to demonstrate that he's beyond the body. Second is that that there may be a prarabdha, that particular soul, the individuality, had to go through certain karmas for that particular body, which he is now fulfilling. Like Ramakrishna Paramhans got throat cancer and he was in severe pain. If you say he's an evolved great master, then how can he be in severe pain, you know? And how come he could not cure his cancer? Because that was the prarabdha, that was the destiny of this body. The third thing is that that sacrifice was meant to inspire others to turn towards Christianity. Otherwise, people would not have, but they said, look, he sacrificed for us. So that inspired so many people to turn towards Christianity. So there is always a purpose in that, higher purpose in that. And it's not that God is punishing them or anything. In fact, God has extreme love for these souls because they are one with him. But the destiny of that individual, maybe from his previous births, was meant for that. Or it was meant for a higher purpose, for a higher cause. Or to demonstrate.
This world is just a dream. How can we be responsible for our actions while we're on the earth?
No, no, it's a dream until you wake up. When you wake up, it becomes a dream. As long as you are in this dream, you're responsible. But when you wake up, then you realize that this world was a dream. Right now, does the world appear to you like a dream?
No.
Appears very real. So then you are responsible for your actions. But when you, the scriptures are meant to wake us up. It's like the example they gave is like you're in the forest and you are roaming around and then a tiger comes. Oh, it scares you loudly and roars. And that wakes you up from your dream, right? And you say, oh, thank God I'm in Bakersfield. I'm not in the forest. So the scriptures are like that tiger that are roaring to us that this world is a dream. Don't keep on sleeping. But we don't listen. When you wake up, but to wake up, you have to follow the scriptures. And the scriptures say you have to be good. You have to love everybody. You have to serve the world and follow all those things.
Otherwise you suffer.
Otherwise you suffer, right? Right.
So you're either a slave to sin or a slave to God. Take your pick.
Right. One or the other. Right.